Welcome to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Today in the program, we talk with the outgoing Woodbury County Sheriff Dave Drew and his successor, Chad Sheehan. Also, a closer look at Iowa's seemingly positive unemployment rate. We talk also with an attorney who fights against extremist groups about this week's unprecedented riot on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. But first, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds has signed a new public health disaster proclamation that modifies existing public health measures designed to reduce the spread of COVID-19. The proclamation continues to require that when people are in an indoor public space and unable to social distance for 15 minutes or longer, masks are required to be worn. Spectator limits for sporting and recreational gatherings, including for high school-sponsored events, will be lifted today. Other public health measures have been extended until February 6th. A Northwest Iowa teacher has died of complications of COVID-19. The Woodbury County Central School District, based in Mobile, is grieving the loss of a beloved middle school social studies teacher and volleyball coach. Board member Donnie Rieblitz talked to Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer about 53-year-old Sherry Dandurand, who died of complications of COVID-19.
Sadness isn't even the right word, just because Sherry was such a integral part of the not only the Woodbury Central School District community, but the Mobile community. I mean, if you can imagine, she was a teacher for 30 years, and along with that, she was a volleyball coach and just touched so many lives in such a small community that it's just sad. Like, her loss will be felt for a very long time. I worry about COVID in general. As a school board member, I feel strongly that the school has taken the right steps to mitigate risks at the school. We have mask mandates, for example. I do think this is, you know, sadly, this is the latest reminder that this is real. This isn't a made-up disease, and that even though that there's vaccines that are slowly being rolling out, it's just the latest reminder that we just have to continuously be vigilant about staying safe, wearing masks, maintaining social distancing, all the things that we know to do. We just need to make sure that we continue to do that until we are completely past this COVID speed bump.
Do they know if she contracted the virus from being in school or something outside in the community?
It was over the break, so I think it's fair to assume that it was contracted outside of the school, but I wouldn't be the right person to ask that. I don't want to understate how much of a role she had within the community. I think that's very important. She was a member of the teachers union at the school, so she would actively negotiate with the school board on annual increases. She was a mentor to so many teachers and coaches. It's just tremendously sad, and for such a positive role model, I'm just so sad for personally. I'm sad for the community, and you know, it's going to take some time to heal. And
you said that she was part of the teachers union. Did she have a high level of concern when it comes to COVID-19? I don't know if that's something you discussed with her at all.
Like a lot of teachers, she was very concerned about COVID-19 and making sure that the school was taking the right measures to mitigate against COVID-19. She was actively advocating at board meetings to make sure that the teachers' voices are being heard. And, you know, I think in large part to some of the advocacy that she was doing, the school did end up adopting a mask mandate.
That was Donnie Rieblitz, an ongoing contributor to the Siouxland Public Media special project, Going Viral, Lessons Learned During the Pandemic. And now moving on to the big story of the week, the protest at the U.S. Capitol, where people gained entrance to the Capitol building, caused violence, and several deaths were involved as well. Governor Reynolds has condemned the violent protests, but remains sympathetic to unfounded assertions questioning the integrity of the presidential election. New 4th District Representative Randy Feenster voted to approve the Electoral College votes this week, despite having concerns about voter fraud since the election. Siouxland Public Media contacted Feenstra for further comment, and we hope to speak with him next week. We also contacted Republican Senators Joni Ernst and Chuck Grassley. Grassley said he wasn't doing interviews this week, but said President Trump displayed poor leadership in his words and actions, and he must take responsibility. Those comments came shortly after Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi on Thursday joined a growing chorus of legislative colleagues calling on Vice President Mike Pence to invoke the 25th Amendment to remove President Trump. Senator Joni Ernst has not yet responded to Siouxland Public Media's request, but put out a statement saying, "For years, we've been able to disagree and debate tough issues, and we strive to be a more perfect union. We had a peaceful transfer of power from one administration to another throughout the course of our history, and it's paramount we do it again." There are several advocacy groups that are fighting against extremist group violence like we saw this week. Integrity for America is one of them. Executive Director Amy Spitalnik says the group is backing a federal lawsuit filed by victims of the August 2017 Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. Spitalnik says anyone who was surprised by this week's events has not been paying attention.
Look, I think what we saw yesterday is the inevitable result of years of hate, of disinformation, of conspiracy theories, and so much more that it shouldn't surprise anyone if you've been paying attention to how this has spread. So it's important to recognize that there are deep through lines that go from yesterday's attack at the U.S. Capitol back to, for example, the attack on Charlottesville, Virginia, 3.5 years ago, which is the basis of our lawsuit against the leaders of the white supremacist movement for their racist, violent conspiracy there. And so many of the same tools, tactics, ideologies, and even some of the same players were at the U.S. Capitol yesterday, underscoring just how deeply connected yesterday's attack is to the broader cycle of extremist violence we're seeing in this country.
One of the people who was listed as a speaker at the Charlottesville rally was live streaming video from the Capitol yesterday. Is that right?
Yes. So there were a few, including Nick Fuentes, who I think is who you're referring to, and someone who goes by the name Baked Alaska. And these are two neo-Nazis who played prominent roles both in Charlottesville and yesterday. And we've also seen so many other images, video coming out of yesterday's attack, whether it be the person wearing a Camp Auschwitz shirt, which is really heinous in so many ways, to the Confederate flags and other white supremacist and Nazi imagery we saw, to the noose that was hung outside the Capitol. This was all part of a much larger effort to lay down a white supremacist marker at the seat of the American government, which should horrify all of us.
Do you think that, like a lot of people have said in the past day or so, people have said to me, well, it seemed that the police and security people really treated these protesters a lot more kindly than, say, the Black Lives Matter protesters have been treated throughout this last year?
I think you just need to look at the facts of the last year to understand how white privilege and white supremacy plays a role in how these protests are treated. We've seen over and over again peaceful protests lead to mass arrests, violence against protesters, and so much more. I think, you know, for example, about the older man in Buffalo, New York, who was knocked to the ground while peacefully protesting in support of Black lives over the summer. And then, of course, you watch what happened yesterday, where so many of these violent white supremacists who literally led an insurrection in the U.S. Capitol were peacefully escorted out. There have been so few arrests compared to the destruction and the violence that we saw over the course of the day yesterday. And the lack of accountability when it comes to the violence and the extremism that these white supremacists and other extremists spread is a factor here. They feel so emboldened, and they're able to so flagrantly attack, whether it be communities, whether it be governmental institutions, because they feel that they can do so and not have to face any real consequences. And so it's so important that we show that there is accountability, that there will be justice for this sort of violent behavior. That's what our work at Integrity First for America is about in bringing our lawsuit against those responsible for the Charlottesville violence. And while we are starting to see some very, very initial news coming out of the government and also out of the Biden transition team about how they intend to deal with what happened yesterday, it's so critical that the federal government send a clear message that there will be severe consequences for violent, racist conspiracies like what happened yesterday.
Do you think that the folks that were doing this yesterday definitely felt that they had the president's permission?
Look, you can't look at the president's comments not only over the last few weeks, but over the last few years and not see how directly they fueled these extremists. And the extremists will say as much. They are not hiding the fact that they hear the president's words and they take them as direct marching orders. Neo-Nazi Andrew England, who runs the Daily Stormer, posted after the stand back, stand by comments this past fall that the president's words were a call to war. And over the last few months, he has been using the president's words to directly encourage all of his followers on his neo-Nazi hate site to go to Washington, to storm the Capitol, and to do all of the violent, heinous things we saw play out yesterday. So not only is the president himself encouraging these people, but these neo-Nazi and other extremist leaders are taking his words and using it to throw further fuel on the fire. And when the president refers to whether it be white supremacists in Charlottesville or insurrectionists at the Capitol as fine people or great people he loves, it has consequences.
What do you think, and I know you're not obviously in the House of Representatives or the Senate, but what do you think should happen here with President Trump?
Well, this is me speaking more in my personal capacity, in that we as an organization are don't lobby and don't. But look, I think there needs to be consequences. The ways in which the fundamental tenets of our democracy have been so not just undermined, but sort of abused and exploited by this administration, not just when it comes to what happened yesterday and what has happened over the last few weeks and months, but in general, is horrifying. And we are going to look back at this time in history and see it as such a blemish on who we are as a country. There needs to be very real consequences. Impeachment, the use of the 25th Amendment, these are all being discussed. And with about 2 weeks left in his administration, it is still important to send a message that we as a country will not tolerate this abuse of power from our leaders. And so while I wish there had been action and consequences much earlier, if it happens now, it will still send a very critical message.
Do you think that with all the coverage of marches and protests, and there's been violence and over the summer and into the fall on TV and online, do you think Americans ever just get kind of inured to seeing that and don't start to not pay attention?
You know, I worry that we have become so complacent when it comes to violent extremism. Charlottesville happened 3.5 years ago, and since then we've really seen a cycle of violence, not just the attacks like Charlottesville and what happened yesterday, which are large-scale violent riots and mobs, but also smaller-scale attacks that directly connect to the larger events but have equally, if not more, deadly consequences, like Pittsburgh, like Poway, like El Paso, and a number of these other extremist attacks over the last few years. We can't lose sight of the fact that we are at a moment where domestic terror, where hate crimes, where anti-Semitism are all at record levels. This is not acceptable. In 2019, the FBI reported that hate crimes hit the deadliest level ever. which is horrifying. And I suspect that the 2020 and 2021 numbers will be equally horrifying. We know that the Department of Homeland Security calls white supremacist terror the most persistent and lethal threat to our country. We need to take these warnings at face value. We need to take these threats at face value and act and not become immune to the fact that this is happening in our country.
That was Amy Spitalnik, executive director of the advocacy group Integrity for America, talking about efforts to stop extremist right-wing violence in the United States, like she says we saw this week on Capitol Hill. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. This week, Sioux City leaders are urging the state of Iowa to help local families get enough to eat. Food banks have been strained ever since the coronavirus pandemic has left so many people out of work and striving to pay their bills. Local leaders say the economic damage caused by the pandemic has significantly increased hunger in the Sioux City area. The Food Bank of Iowa says more than 300,000 Iowans struggle with hunger, including more than 100,000 Iowa children. For months, local churches, schools, and agencies have made a massive effort to respond. At a virtual news conference this week, advocates said the state of Iowa should and must provide more help. Gene Logan is the executive director of the Community Action Agency of Siouxland. At that news conference, she said that churches and nonprofits are carrying the burden in the community, but that is not sustainable.
Food in Sioux City and the need is just critical at this point in time. I think we've all seen rising demands. Sunnybrook Church rolled out almost a year ago, or maybe it was a year ago today, a new program that they had going called the Hope Center. And they are doing, they intended for that to be like a grocery store shopping experience where people could pick up not only food, but they could pick up things like deodorant and toilet paper and paper towels and some other household needs. They have gone to delivering to the car now, and they are serving 400 families a week.
Sioux City State Senator Jackie Smith organized the news conference. She says Iowa state government has more than $1 billion in reserve funds. And next Monday, when the state legislature starts up for its 2021 session, she hopes other lawmakers will agree that state reserve funds should be used to help all Iowa families become hunger-free.
January 11th is when we go back to session. We can submit legislation, try and get bipartisan legislation. This is not a Democrat or Republican issue. This is, you know, an issue that doesn't know political parties. So hopefully we can get some, cooperation and bipartisan agreement.
Senator Smith says the problems caused by the pandemic come on top of poverty and food insecurity issues that have plagued Siouxland residents for a long time.
We have that Alice report that comes from United Way that talks about people that are working and living on the edge. And a lot of those folks, so while they're, you know, they have jobs, they still don't have enough to live day to day. And they're one, as many of us are, just one catastrophe away from needing, you know, assistance.
Smith said that expanding existing programs that purchase fresh produce, dairy, and meat products from Iowa farmers would be a help, as well as expanding food banks, food pantries, soup kitchens, congregate meal providers, and home food deliveries for families and seniors, and permanently exempting food banks, food pantries, and congregate meal providers from the Iowa sales tax. She also urged Iowa residents to contact their state lawmakers and ask them to help out with this effort. You are listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Well, the end of 2020 brought retirement to many, including Woodbury County Sheriff Dave Drew. The 60-year-old spent 8 years leading the local sheriff's office. Drew reflected on his long career and the evolution of law enforcement with Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer.
I'm excited, a little nervous about the future. You know, I've been in law enforcement for 39 years, but I'm used to, you know, being in this profession that long. So a little excited about the future, but a little apprehensive because you don't know. I think anybody that's been in this line of work, they always think they're in control, and though we're not, it is a little different because I'm not quite sure what all is going to take place.
No, that's true. And, you know, looking back, wow, you've had 37 years with the Sheriff's Department. What are some of the highlights over that those many decades that you worked for our county?
Really, my whole time has just been, I just really enjoyed being in law enforcement. A lot of different challenges that came up over the time. But I think if I go back historically, when I started, I remember the technology we used, it what would be referred to as a wheel gun or a revolver. And we really thought we were coming a long ways. We were going to go to these speed loaders. You could have six rounds and you could just kind of dump them right into the cylinder. And it was that was big technology then. And today, you know, all the advanced equipment, you know, back then we used nightsticks. And now today, you know, we've kind of gotten away from that. We use a taser. Some of the things that we have progressed more in learning more about de-escalation. That's probably the biggest thing. Some of the changes, I think we are more empathetic. We listen better than quick reaction. So I think over time, we have really advanced the profession. It's been fun to see all the changes.
Now, when it comes to the profession, you know, which is everything that's been happening socially in our country this past year, it would be easy to say that it's not an easy profession anymore for people to get into. Are you finding that?
When I started, there was probably 100 that applied. And we just tested the other day, and we had 22. And that's kind of the same going throughout the country. I remember when I was testing, I was 20 years old, 21 years old, and I tested down in Omaha at the police department. There was 800 that took that test, and you know, I was in the top 100 or something. And I ended up getting on with the sheriff's office. And same with in Sioux Falls. There was probably 200. Sioux Falls at that time was the same size as Sioux City. So I got offered this job there and here, and well, this was home, and I was going to stay at home, so you know, it all worked out. There is definitely a number difference, but I would say this: the candidates that we have now are very committed, and that's really what we want, versus sometimes when the job market isn't that good and then people think, oh well, I can get into law enforcement, and sometimes they last and sometimes they don't, but so I think the candidates we get now are very, very committed.
And obviously over that time, too, there were some things that must have been a bit difficult for you to deal with or to have happen while you were in law enforcement.
In law enforcement, one of the things that sheriffs and the state patrol, especially, both of us have to deal with is often death notifications because it's out in a rural area. And that is probably one that sticks with you. That you have to go to someone's home and tell the parents that, you know, their son or daughter or tell the wife or husband got killed. That is gut-wrenching. You never forget it. And so when I took office, we developed a chaplaincy program to have them come with us and help us because it's that's really tough to do. And that's really not a lot of training, but just go and do it. And so we have changed that. We don't want you going by yourself. We want you to find a clergy member that can help you in this because, you know, it's very difficult.
Now, I know one thing about you. I've known you for many, many years. You have a big heart, and I think that's evident with how you've operated the office and your work with the Sheriff's Department.
I service to others means a great deal. And I think that if you show kindness, you go a lot farther than maybe some of the other tactics. I think you just are a better servant if you get down on their level and explain things and not be authoritarian. There is a time for that. But I think you go farther by having some empathy And there's just difficult times people go through. People make mistakes and make poor choices. I remember when I worked 8 years in the drug task force, and we arrested a lot of people, obviously, for methamphetamine. It was really an epidemic. It was huge in our area. And there was people making really poor decisions because of drug addiction. And I don't think they were, drug dealers per se, but the system that was in place at that time, I think, was sometimes unfairly, because if they had some past criminal history, their years of prison grew exponentially. And I'm not sure that was should have been the case, because they had a drug addiction. So I had a lot of empathy for them. You know what? The nice part of that is, years later, they have a number of them have gotten out and become a good, productive member of the community. And I see them different places, and it's always feels good when they come up to you and thank you. And I tell them, you don't have to thank me. You are the one that made the change, and I'm proud of you. You know, so that's a good feeling. I think if I go away from some of this job thinking that maybe in a small way I was, had an ear for people and took the time to listen. And that's, I think, the way I would want to be remembered.
With the new jail, that was one of the other accomplishments during your tenure. But there's actually a new mindset where, you try to make sure that people have the tools they need mentally. I mean, you have a lot of people mentally ill who are in jail and that kind of thing. And I'm sure that's something that you guys have worked on over the years as well.
Well, we have. And, we have a gentleman upstairs that spends, Rick Broshead. We did that through our American Correctional Health Services that we convinced the county to use. So we had 24/7 nursing. And Greg is, he can help us dealing with those people with some mental health challenges. And try to get them on their meds, get them back into the community. When we were housing people because they failed to show up for mental health hearings, it was hard to believe that that's what would happen. But the courts had no other. The courts' hands were tied. So I think we all agree this is a horrible way to deal with people that had mental health issues. So we worked hard. And I think, all 99 county sheriffs worked hard to get that change, some of that legislative changes, so that we didn't really have to have people with mental health issues in our jail. We've come a long ways, and there's still a long ways to go, but dealing with people with mental health issues and incarcerating them is just a horrible idea, and it's just beyond me. But, when you talk about the new jail, and I know it was a lot to bite off, but this building was decaying fast, and we were just going to continue to have issues. But the amount of people that we house in there now, it's just not designed for that. So one of the upswings, I think, is, as far as I'm concerned, that we could maybe get some people some not only mental health help, but opportunities. We belong in this program, the Boost program, where we take people. We don't house 16-year-olds, but juvenile extensionists, 16 to 25, and we help them to get their feet back on the ground to possibly get back into the workforce and make some positive changes. So I'm kind of happy with that program. We'll be able to develop some programs in the new jail that could help us to, so we don't have people reoffending, because there is no success in our society as all we're doing is reincarcerating people. We need to get some behavioral changes, and some of that is through counseling and peer support and all these programs, and they are valuable for a community that's going to thrive.
So what is next for you? I know you've been a longtime referee for different games and that kind of thing. Are you going to still do that, or what's next for you as you retire?
I'm going to continue to referee basketball because the way I put it, I don't think my wife can tolerate me in the winter. So she likes to see me go out and referee so that way she can have the remote control. But, I've done that for 23 winters. It's just been a great release from my job. And it's just something I enjoy. I enjoy being out there with the kids and the coaches and the athletic directors, developed a relationship over all those years with different coaches and athletic directors. It's just a great release, some exercise. And I don't know if I'm keeping up that well anymore, but I'm sure trying.
It looks like you also have something else you're going to be doing as well.
Western Iowa Tech Community College has asked me to help out with the Regional Law Enforcement Academy. I'll be overseeing that. And that's twice a year for area law enforcement agencies that hire new people. And then we'll have our regional academy here, which will save a substantial amount of money for departments instead of going to Des Moines. We can go through the short course here at Western Iowa Tech Community College. So that's a great program, and I'm just glad to be a part of that. And then I'm going to teach a couple classes to the police science program. I'm a graduate of Western Iowa Tech Police Science, so I have nothing but the utmost thoughts of this program. Always have. Graduated from it back in 81, and it's just a great program. I'm glad to be a part of it. We hired the sheriff's office, local police departments, and state patrol. We hire a lot of people from the police science program. And so I'm going to teach a little, real comfortable with part-time, because I have plans to ride a motorcycle most of the summer and play golf.
That sounds like a good plan. Well, best of luck to you. And we really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. Is there anything else that you'd like to say, something that I didn't ask or something that's on your mind that you would like to share as well before you go?
Well, I would just say this. There's a couple things. One, I wouldn't be able to do this as long as I did if I didn't have a supporting wife that really was my sounding board, my support, just the encourager. So I owe my wife, who has always sat in the sidelines and been the one who cheered me on. She should get most of this credit. And then lastly, obviously, the public I've served for all these years. This has been a great community to be involved in. This is my home. And, growing up, I'm sure a lot of teachers had me would have never thought that I'd end up being the sheriff. But you know what? It all worked out. But in all honesty, I owe a lot to the public I serve. They have been more than gracious and have made this just a tremendous time in my life.
No, that's great. Best of luck. And maybe we'll see you out here at campus.
Yes, I will. Looking forward to it, Sheila.
And that was former Woodbury County Sheriff Dave Drew. Former Sioux City Police Officer Chad Sheehan is the new Woodbury County Sheriff. Sheehan worked for the Sioux City Department as a community policing officer. He attended meetings to listen to the public's concerns. He worked also as a school resource officer, and he worked in the Crime Prevention Bureau. Sheehan attended training seminars on active shooters and realized he could improve on the classes. He started his own consulting company called Sheehan Strategic Solutions. It provides training for responding to active shooter incidents and workplace violence. When Drew announced in January he would not be seeking re-election, Sheehan saw his chance and announced his candidacy in March. In the June Republican primary, Sheehan defeated Sheriff's Deputy Major Todd Wick. He was unopposed in the November general election. Sheehan says he would like to work for more transparency in the sheriff's department going forward, and he would also like to use his experience in training to help all police officers do their job better.
Well, I would say that training for the organization will definitely be a priority. I think, I do have a lot of experience in training, not just when I was with the sheriff's office, but running my own business. And so I do understand training, and I think I want to utilize our Prairie Hills Training Center to bring in other instructors from all over the country to come here and train not only our department, but agencies from around the area as well. And I think a lot of that experience will be beneficial in bringing more training, more quality training to the sheriff's office to try and create the best deputies and the best correctional officers that we possibly can.
Looking at this past year, so much discussion about how the police handles various situations, not just active shooter situations, like I know you've trained people for, but issues involving how the police work with people from different
you know, walks of life, minorities. I guess, how would you go forward, you know, looking at what's been done? And I know Sioux City did not suffer too much through this, as some other cities did this summer with the BLM movement.
Well, I started forming what I'm calling a diversity advisory board, in which I've been reaching out to different members in the community from all walks of life, and giving them all a voice, and also allowing me to reach out to different community members from different different minority groups, different all types of different groups, and that I can contact if issues arise. I would say, though, that you know, my history and my life experience, I think, speaks for itself. I grew up in a biracial family, not my immediate family, but my very close extended family, and I, as an officer, always worked in predominantly minority areas. I took it upon myself to go back and learn Spanish as much as I could. Was able to pass a Spanish proficiency test when I was with the police department. And I did that so that I could communicate with the Hispanic community in the neighborhoods that I was working in. And so I hope that that I will lead by example. And, you know, everybody we deal with should be treated with, you know, with respect, treated with empathy. And, you know, that's something that I will demand out of all of our employees. And like I said, leading by example and setting that example, I think is very important.
You talk a lot too about, having more transparency, and this kind of might go along with what you were just saying, you know, having a good relationship with various communities.
Absolutely. And I would say, you know, you mentioned it, that, our area did not suffer some of the violence and destruction that other areas of the country suffered. And I say that that wasn't by accident. That was the work that had been done by law enforcement in our area over the last 25 or 30 years. And I was part of our community policing unit, with the Sioux City Police Department, the community policing unit. And we have continually reached out and communicated with different groups who may be, you know, underrepresented, but making sure that they have a voice and that their voice is heard, and that we're not keeping them in the dark when things happen, that we communicate openly. And I think that that's a very important thing to continue to do. And I know Sheriff Drew was exceptional at doing that, and I will continue on that path, and we'll have people from all walks of life as part of our organization when we can, and we'll be open to communicate with anybody that wants to have a say or have a voice with the sheriff's office.
I know the new jail is a project that Sheriff Drew was very much in favor of, you know, having it go forward. Looks like it is going forward. I think that is something that caused a lot of, in some parts of the community, concern about, you know, building a bigger jail. But I think it turned out that jail was needed for a whole host of reasons. Are you pretty glad that jail is going forward?
Absolutely. The jail... the jail was necessary for a lot of reasons, some of which, you know, are the limitations of the current building and the number of inmates that are housed in the facility. We're out of room. The HVAC system is not, I mean, it's on its last breaths, shall we say. So the ability to build a new facility with all the new and modern technologies that exist now compared to 30 years ago, this is going to be a state-of-the-art jail. It's going to make it safer for the correctional officers who are working there, safer for inmates who are in there, and safer for everybody that's involved in the criminal justice system. And that's a priority for us.
Yeah, and also, right, don't they also do their court appearances there, at least some of them anyway?
Yes, there are courtrooms there. Basically the same, some of it hasn't all been finalized, but it'll be the same courts that are currently in the law enforcement center. And so, yes, we won't have to transport people. They'll have their initial hearings and appearances there. Again, it's all built around the safety of the public, the safety of the workers, the correctional officers, and the safety of the people who are being held there.
What have you heard from people sort of in the run-up to your starting the job? Have people been talking to you, asking you questions? And
when you say people, do you mean within the organization?
Oh, no, I mean like in the community. Have you heard from people?
Oh, yes. Yep, I've heard from a lot of people, you know, especially during the campaign. A really hot-button topic was the new law enforcement center. It's a very large project. It's a large budget. And people were concerned that we spend that money wisely and that we get a building that's going to last a lot longer than the building we're in now. And so working with the Law Enforcement Center Authority Board, which is chaired by Ron Wick, and then Rocky DeWitt and Dan Moore are on that board. And I think the people that are working on this project are doing everything that we can to make sure that money is spent wisely, and that we get a building that is going to outlast all of us, hopefully.
Was there anything else that you would like to say to people, you know, that you'd like them to know, or you just think it's something important people should hear?
Yeah, I would like to tell people that, you know, I'm honored and humbled to represent the citizens of Woodbury County as the 34th sheriff of Woodbury County. And I want to let people know that the people that work at the sheriff's office, they do an outstanding job, and they come to work every day in tough circumstances and tough environment. And we're out there doing everything we can to ensure the safety of you and your family. And we will continue to do so. And we will continue to strive to do the best job that we can. And that in the future, we will be reaching out to the different communities through town halls to ensure that we are hearing from the citizens and finding out firsthand what they need from the sheriff's office. And so as we start to have those, when COVID will allow sometime in the future, I would encourage people to get involved and come to those and make sure that we continue to build these partnerships that have been started under Dave Drew's leadership, and we'll continue to move forward.
And that was Chad Sheehan. He is the new Woodbury County Sheriff. He takes over from longtime Sheriff Dave Drew, who retired at the end of 2020. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. Support for The Exchange comes from Gregory Giles, investment advisor representative with Legacy Financial LLC in Sioux City, serving the financial planning and investment needs of clients since 2004. Information about Legacy Financial and Greg Giles is available at legacyfinancialllc.com. Financial planning and advisory services offered through RDA Financial Network. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. The state of Iowa has reported 7 additional coronavirus-related deaths so far this week, raising the state total to nearly 4,000. Iowa's per capita death rate moved up one notch to the 14th highest in the nation, with 126.5 deaths per 100,000 people, according to Johns Hopkins University. Iowa's death toll in 2020 is the single highest year total since at least 1915. And because the coronavirus continues to spread, it is having an effect on the economy. But some state offices say Iowa's economy has snapped back since the pandemic came to the state last March. Iowa's unemployment rate has decreased for 7 consecutive months after peaking at 11%. Some state officials point towards Iowa's decreasing unemployment rate as a, quote, very good sign, but some economists are skeptical of the state's economic progress since April. ISU economist Dave Swenson says that rate is going down for the wrong reason. The unemployment rate comes from the number of unemployment claims divided by the civilian labor force. The state's labor force has shrunk to an historically low level. Between November 2019 and November of last year, one out of every 13 Iowa workers left the labor force and just stopped looking for a job. Svensson says that large number of people leaving the workforce continues to be a problem and will be a problem in the future.
Yeah, what's happened in Iowa, and to a degree in the nation, but it really stands out in Iowa, is that while we've had substantial apparent recovery in our unemployment rate, the reason that unemployment rate has gone down so sharply is because many people have left the labor force. Let me give you a number. If we look at April, that's when the worst of this pandemic recession hit us. And unemployment in the state of Iowa has gone down by over 130,000 persons. But we've only added 37,000 more employed persons.
Could you explain a little more about how that works?
93,000 or 72% of that improvement in unemployment is from people leaving the labor force. For every person who entered the labor force or recovered their jobs within the labor force and found employment, about two people left the labor force. And so our unemployment rate looks enviably low, but it portends some serious problems in the state's economy and its longer-term recovery. Now, let me tell you how this all worked out. We have two different measures. We have the measure of you and me and whether we're employed or not. And then we have another survey that tells us, well, you know, who has a job and how many jobs are there out in the economy. From a year ago, we still have 82,000 or so fewer jobs in the economy. But since that worst of that pandemic recession, which occurred in April, Iowa's jobs, the number of jobs in the state of Iowa, has improved every single month over the period of time, May, June, July, August, September, October, even to November. Our job numbers improved, even though our labor force continued to get smaller at that time. Our labor force continued to shrink in May, June, July, and August, even though the number of jobs in the state went up. And so that's really a big issue with regard to what's going on with the labor force. Now, we know a little bit about what's going on.
And you say that a lot of women have been forced out of the labor force.
A lot of mothers, women, have been forced out of the labor force because they have childcare issues. They either have difficulty finding childcare or they're not comfortable with childcare options in their area because of the pandemic. And for one reason or another, this burden tends to fall on women more so than men, and women have left the labor force. We also know that mothers are also much more likely to be at home with children who are doing distance learning. The other characteristics of the loss in the labor force are a little bit hard to suss out. We're not quite sure what it is. But what we do know is that there has been a massive decline in the number of leisure and hospitality and entertainment type of jobs. And people who may have been in the labor force and worked in seasonal kinds of jobs didn't get a chance to do that this last year, so many of them may also have dropped out of the labor force. So it's a good news, bad news story. The good news is our unemployment rate is low. The bad news is it's low for the wrong reason.
So, you know, looking ahead and seeing how this might affect us, what could be the long-term effect of this?
Yeah, well, the long-term effect of this, first of all, going into this pandemic, we were not a growing state. Our economy had flatlined. It had not been growing for the better part of the last year. So even though there is the appearance of economic recovery, in fact, we're likely not to have as many jobs over the course of 2021 into 2022 as we actually had prior to the to this pandemic. So we're going to probably have a slower recovery. What's happening in Iowa with regard to its labor force contraction is happening in the U.S., but not anywhere to the degree that it happened in Iowa. So that's why we're paying particular attention. It is an issue at the national level. It will slow the rate of recovery nationally, but we really do have to ask these questions. What will it take to bring these people back into the labor force? And what it's going to take probably to bring these people back into the labor force is a relatively well-functioning, well-performing economy that is rid of all of the pandemic-related impediments to growth.
You know, I think the question for a lot of people is, what do we need to do to get there? Because a lot of people say, well, if you shut down the economy, then people don't have work. And others say, well, if you don't shut down part of it, then this continues to spread and we just keep pushing off the what we need to happen, some kind of getting back to normal.
Yeah, we have twin responsibilities. First of all, the economy, despite what some governors might say, cannot be healthier than the workforce. And if the workforce is not well or is at threat of becoming unwell, then the workforce cannot thrive and the economy can't thrive. So that it's this trade-off between the economy and the health of the population is one of those things that gets thrown out there. It's a political discussion, it's a practical discussion, but the fact of the matter is the economy can't be any healthier than the workforce. So the speed with which we get the workforce healthy, which involves them not getting sick in the first place, and now in the upcoming months, making sure that we have an effective deployment of the vaccines, that's going to determine how well we recover, how soon we recover, and how durable the recovery is.
Do you have any recommendations yourself on how to make this better or how to get there sooner?
Well, the recommendations we were told about that are most effective are the ones that started at the beginning. Social distancing, do what you can to minimize the spread of this disease, follow all of the COVID-related protocols, and in businesses, make sure that you're protecting. If you're an open business, you should be protecting your employees and not subjecting them to risks of COVID exposure or COVID infection. And the more we do of those things, the healthier the workforce is going to be, and the more likely we are to be able to move back into a good, strong recovery mode.
You say you're up in the Black Hills, right?
Yeah.
What's it like up there when we talk about the spread of COVID?
You know, South Dakota has the second worst infection rate of COVID behind North Dakota and just in front of Iowa, but substantially above Iowa. And there is a difference out here. This is a state that's open for business. You see virtually no real meaningful public policies that are impeding business in any way. People are dining out with no spatial restrictions or occupancy restrictions. And as you look around out here in the Black Hills, as I've witnessed it, there's a lot of indifference to the basics of personal protection. There's a much lower rate of mask wearing, much higher rate of in-person dining when you go in, and I haven't gone into, but when you drive by a restaurant, you'll see that there's many of the places that the people aren't wearing masks, not just the diners, but the help as well. You couldn't pay me enough money to go into a South Dakota restaurant right now.
You know, it is amazing to me the intersection of the economy and public health and people's attitudes towards public health. It is amazing the huge effect that has had.
Yeah, I'm sitting here isolating with convalescing elderly parents right now who've had health issues, and I'm just simply doing my best to try to keep them healthy and get them through this over the course of the next few months, but I can only stay here so long. I got to go back to work, and I worry like the Dickens as to how exposed they might be. Either of them, if they have to venture out, either for groceries or healthcare needs or for whatnot. And it's been a concern all along, but it is palpably different in South Dakota than it is, say, in downtown Des Moines or downtown Ames or a lot of our cities in Iowa. I can't speak to how it is in rural Iowa, but I can tell you what it's like in the cities, and the cities seem to be practicing a wide range of COVID protection protocols.
Yeah, I know in Sioux Falls, the city council finally approved a mask requirement, I guess a mask mandate, but that took a while.
It did take a while, and they've attempted to do it here up here in Rapid City as well. Again, it's a different type of culture, and their politics are a little bit more strident than our politics in Iowa, but probably not that much different from Northwestern Iowa's politics. So it's leading to different types of attitudes towards the requirement of protecting one another by wearing masks and imposing restrictions.
That was Iowa State University economist Dave Svensson talking about the large number of people in Iowa who are no longer counted among the unemployed because they have stopped looking for work. Svensson is spending time in the Black Hills caring for his parents, and he heads back to Ames to teach next week. And state lawmakers are heading back to Des Moines on Monday to start the 2020 session. On Tuesday evening at 6, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds will deliver her Condition of the State address. Siouxland Public Media will bring you live coverage of the address and live reaction from local Republican and Democratic Party leaders. That Condition of the State speech will be live on Siouxland Public Media at 6 p.m. next Tuesday. And you can hear more about the governor's initiatives and the major bills before the state legislature next Wednesday on The Exchange. And finally today, some good news for Sioux City tourism. A plan to revitalize Sioux City's riverfront got a big boost this week. The Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs awarded the Chris Larson Park Redevelopment Project $400,000. It was the biggest amount of the $1.25 million handed out to 9 communities across the state as part of the Iowa Great Places Program. Phase one of the more than $12 million project broke ground in June. It includes a new public park in the place where the Argosy Casino used to sit. The park will include an overlook, 3 shelters, basketball courts, and take about 2 years to complete. Well, that's it for this edition of The Exchange. Thanks to Sheila Brummer and Steve Smith. I'm Mary Hartnett. We'll see you next week.